Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's June 2023, and this is episode 344, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about the TV series Mrs. Davis that is currently streaming on Peacock. On this episode, I'm joined by Cole Burgett, who is a frequent contributor to the Christian Research Journal. He is a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary and the Moody Bible Institute. He teaches classes for high school and college students in Bible exposition and systematic theology. He also writes extensively about theology and popular culture. Cole has written an in-depth TV series review of Mrs. Davis, and his review is called Mrs. Davis and the Crisis of Storytelling in the 21st Century. You can read it for free at our website, equip.org. Cole, it's good to have you on the podcast again.
It's always good to be here. Thank you.
As I mentioned today, we're talking about, in very spoiler-filled, of course, the Peacock channel, that's formerly NBC, and you can also watch it on their app, a new series called Mrs. Davis, and it's an anthology series, which means it's a self-contained, it won't have future seasons, but it's a self-contained story that's become popular a little bit on streaming services. And it was put together by executive producer Damon Lindelof, who many, many years ago, if you're a longtime subscriber to the Christian Research Journal, you know we did a cover story on his series that made him famous, and that is Lost. So he's kind of got a lot of credentials since then. He was involved with the series called The Leftovers and more recently Watchmen, both on HBO. And so this is a new series that he's doing for traditional network television called Mrs. Davis. And when I saw the synopsis of it, I thought it'd be interesting for Postmodern Realities and the journal in our cultural apologetics section, because it brings together all kinds of different topics into one show. So can you give us a general overview of the series Mrs. Davis and who its characters are and just like the general plot lines of it?
Sure. So Mrs. Davis follows a nun, actually, this individual named Sister Simone, who's ousted from her convent and goes after the person responsible. It turns out the person responsible is not so much a person as it is a very powerful artificial intelligence called Mrs. Davis. Now, the deal that Simone cuts with this artificial intelligence is that if she finds the Holy Grail, and I know that seems kind of odd, but if she finds the Holy Grail, then the artificial intelligence will shut itself down. And the whole purpose of the Holy Grail, trying to find the Holy Grail, is because it's sort of the most cliched MacGuffin. If you know what a MacGuffin is in storytelling, MacGuffin is just a term that is used for something that motivates the characters. And you've seen these in sort of popular blockbusters over the years. In The Rise of Skywalker, there was the dagger. They had to find the dagger. And the fact that it's a dagger is not so much significant as it's a plot device to move the story forward. Mission Impossible 3, finding the rabbit's foot. You never actually find out what the rabbit's foot is. It's just a plot device that moves, that motivates the characters and moves the narrative forward. And the Holy Grail throughout literature and history is sort of one of those overused quest items, find the Holy Grail, taken out of Arthurian myth and things like that. And so this show sort of revolves around Sister Simone searching for the Holy Grail. And she teams up with her ex-boyfriend, this guy named Wiley, who is leading this underground resistance movement dedicated to stopping this artificial intelligence. So they, you know, navigate this world of secret societies and legends and religious conspiracies and things like that. And, you know, I was kind of like you, and I heard the setup of this show. I thought, oh this will be a fairly interesting approach. This should be pretty good for somebody like me. You know, it's got a bunch of history and religion and technology and all that stuff. And I, I was very wrong in my initial assessment, but the ingredients were there for it to at least be an interesting show.
Now, I did hear from you that you were not going to finish the entire show, as maybe your reaction just a few moments ago noted. You had a very visceral reaction to the three episodes that you did watch, and you didn't finish it. And in fact, when I first started watching the show and I watched, I actually did finish it, and we'll get into it. It left me scratching my head a little bit, but I was watching it and I'm like, what is this? I mean, is this supposed to be Monty Python? Is this supposed to be about, because they're very Monty Python-esque, even in the first episode moments. Is this some surrealist Dada thing? I mean, there's a scene like that in the show where there's loosely tied plot to this guy that he's in this field of pianos. And then is it supposed to be about serious relationships? Because she goes back and tells Sister Simone, tells her story, like her origin story with her parents and all kinds of things. So I just did not know what this show was supposed to be about. But interestingly, on my Facebook page, when I was just mentioning we were going to do a podcast on this, and I just thought, I didn't know who this show was exactly for. And you just mentioned you thought the show would be for you. Someone who is not a religious person said, I love this show. This show is exactly the kind of show for me. And I just absolutely love it, which I found very interesting. But can you begin unpacking for our listeners why you had such a visceral reaction to this show?
Yeah, I made it three episodes. Now I should probably, there's eight episodes total, but I made it through three of them. It's not quite halfway. I should probably preface this by saying I am a very forgiving film goer. I think that's sort of a lot of my friends are kind of surprised to figure that out about me, that I can usually roll with just about anything. So long as it's not too gratuitous or anything like that, I'm usually a pretty forgiving film goer. But this show is a little different. And I started to get the sense in the first episode or two where there is a religious undercurrent throughout the series. I mean, the main characters are none, of course, there's going to be. But the way, like I said, it has all the ingredients to kind of be a really interesting show that explores not just faith versus science, you know, that age-old debate, or faith versus reason, but something more like faith versus technology. The whole concept of the show is very of the moment, right? The development of the show would have had to have entered last year, something like that, 2 years ago, something like that. And just now, this artificial intelligence stuff is blowing up. So the show is, you know, very of the moment. It's very prescient in that way. But the tone of the piece is what started to rub me the wrong way. Now, I think I've probably mentioned on here before that for me, as someone who's written screenplays, who's produced films, things like that, tone is like the holy grail to me, no pun intended. If you can nail tone, you can do just about anything you want, so long as the audience knows what they're supposed to feel at any given moment. And this show tonally is all over the place. And that's by design. And that's part of the problem I had with it. Because in the third episode, there's a little bit more revealing of the characters going on. And one of the things that is revealed about Sister Simone is that she has this husband figure named Jay. Now, if you're just thinking about this for a half a second, right, you start to connect the dots and figure it out. Jay is Jesus, and she's a nun. She's married to Jesus. But the way that Jesus is portrayed in this show is, you know, very sort of sexy. He's very clean cut. He's a very smooth sort of guy. And, you know, whatever. But at the end of the third episode, when she sort of tells her ex-boyfriend, who is sort of trying all of these things to get her back, that she can't go back to him because she's married to Jesus, he has this sort of moment that is meant to be comedy. where he just starts ranting and blaspheming Jesus. And when I say this, I don't mean this in like it's a very subtle way. It's a very, very explicit sort of thing. There's no mincing of words, to put it that way. And it's not even that I have a problem with the fact that it happened, because I think in the right context, a moment like that can actually be very powerful and very honest and genuine and sincere to the emotions of people who have been in that situation or had that kind of visceral reaction toward Jesus. I mean, I've prayed some pretty interesting prayers in my life and in the heat of the moment. So it's not the fact that the words are said. It's the tone with which the show is conducting it that really, really rubbed me the wrong way, to the point where at the end of that third episode, I thought, I'm not even halfway through this show. I already hate it. I'm not going to waste my time watching anymore. The blasphemy is sort of what got to me because of the context in which it happens. The tone of the show is something like, it could be Monty Python, but not. At least Monty Python, you know sort of when it's being outlandish. This show toes the line in ways that, to me, it comes across as lazy writing. To me, it looks very insincere. It looks like writers who are either too afraid or are too hesitant to actually try to take a stand and say something definitive and interesting and profound. So instead, they just throw in some irony and satire, like the way that they would satirize Jesus as, again, a very sexy sort of figure. They throw all of those ingredients together and don't really attempt to say anything meaningful. And at that point, I just thought, you know, I've got better things to do with my time. So I dipped, as the kids say, after the third episode.
When I was thinking of Monty Python, I was actually thinking of the film in the 1980s called The Adventures of Baron von Munchausen, which was done by a Monty Python alum. I think it was Terry Gilliam. But anyway, they had like writing on the screen that was, you know, pretty humorous before they opened a scene. And so I thought of that in the first episode. So I thought, oh, this is going to be interesting. But as the show went on, it just, we will talk about further, it descended into not just weirdness, but a lot of just the blasphemy really was over the top a little bit. And I'm going to ask you a question about that. And as Christians could read it, but there were a few times that I was watching, especially when there were some big reveals at the end, I said out loud to myself, are you kidding? Like it made the blasphemy even worse, in my opinion. So I just definitely want to talk to you about that. But I did agree that it was a very blasphemous representation of how they were depicting Jesus.
Yeah. So you actually saw more than I did. And I know that as we were sort of talking about it beforehand, and I was kind of telling you, there's no way I'm finishing this. You were telling me that like it only gets worse.
Yeah, I mean, there was a big reveal. So they represent the Trinity. They don't want to say anything about the Spirit, but they represent the Trinity as like there's Jesus, who's Jay, and he runs this diner. And then all these things start happening in the real world that affect Jesus, that she's got to now then go save Jesus a little bit. It's really odd. And when I say she, I mean Sister Simone. And there is this door where we were originally talking about the plot a little bit, so I'll just say this. It's not really any major spoilers to the actual plot, because I'm just not even sure what the whole point of this one interlude is. But there's this door that says, keep out, you know, no trespassers allowed, or something like that. Like, do not enter. And so every time she would go, and you get the idea that must be God the Father in there, because Jay's like, no, you can't open that door. So finally, this major thing happens, which, interestingly, Simone has to descend into the belly of a whale. True. And then these things, she's transported back to this diner where Jesus is, Jay, and the door is open, this, you know, door that's been very secretive. And she goes in there, and guess who is in there? This whole time, it's the Virgin Mary, depicted as an old woman who's holding a baby who's supposed to be Jesus. So like I said, it just gets more fantastical. Now, I was just wondering, like, one of the writers, I don't know if she threw that in there, one of the executive producers, what I should say, who's also one of the writers. She comes from a Roman Catholic background. Damon Lindelof is Jewish, but I don't think he's practicing. But he grew up in a very, very observant Orthodox Jewish town in New Jersey, right close to New York City. And so I've actually been to his hometown, and for sure, I mean, everything closes down at 4 p.m. on Saturdays because of the Sabbath for Orthodox Jews. So I don't think his family was religious, but he grew up in that kind of thing. So that's what I said by it's getting worse. I mean, they open the door and it's like, quote unquote, the Virgin Mary as like this 70-year-old or 60-year-old woman holding a baby Jesus.
Yeah, that's bizarre. I did not make it to that part. Yeah. I read.
And it is bizarre because in the midst of when she discovers this, she's in the belly of a whale.
See, this is what I meant when I was saying, talking about the ingredients of the show. When you look at the just the 30,000 foot view, right, without really trying to talk about how it's executed, but you just look at the ideas that are there, you would think that this would be the perfect kind of show to appeal to a religious audience. And that was, I think, the thing that was my biggest problem with the show, honestly, was I'm watching this stuff and I start thinking to myself, wait a minute, I am the target audience for something like this. And yet the show is going out of its way to alienate me. It's going out of its way to reduce to parody that which I take seriously. Now, let me be very clear. I think Christians can be some of the most self-serious and pretentious and uptight people on the face of the planet, and it bothers me to no end. Make no mistake, satire and irony are important, and having a sense of irony and having a sense of humor is salvific, really. That's what I think. You have to be able to laugh and you have to be able to find humor in situations. But again, it's the tone. The fact that the tone is consistently one of parody, it's consistently one of not just satire, but of intentionally not taking seriously anything resembling an honest-to-goodness emotion, especially in matters of faith. That was what was alienating to me. Because I would watch that scene at the end of the third episode and I think, well, there are people out there who have expressed those same emotions directly, you know, kind of directing them at Jesus for like really good reasons. And this show has absolutely no interest in giving even an ounce of sincerity, an ounce of respect to that kind of person. It's all done as sort of satire. And I think had the show been able to balance a little bit more the sincerity of faith and alongside the more humorous elements, I'd have been far more open to it. And I kind of was worried I was judging it prematurely, right? Because the only way you know how a story, what it means, is where it ends. So I read the plot summary and everything to figure out how it ends. And, you know, I read some of the producers' comments and things like that, and I realized that there's nothing here. This is a vacuum. It is a void. And, you know, the writers even say that, the producers even say that, one of the directors even say that, that by the end of the show, the grander themes, faith, religion, technology, all of that goes by the wayside to focus on just the personal stories between the characters. Well, you know, it seems sort of insincere, and it seems a little reductionist to make a show about those types of lofty themes and assertions and then come away saying, well, none of it really matters anyway. That's sort of sliding millions of people who really are interested in those topics, who really would like to see something that finally takes this kind of thing seriously and not in like a Terminator kind of way. So I just thought that was sort of interesting.
The premise of Mrs. Davis, as you have now discovered in this podcast, is about an all-powerful algorithm. Well, I don't know if the current algorithms on the internet are anywhere near as
powerful as a fictional one called Mrs. Davis, but they do influence who can see content and how it's seen. And basically, we would like you to help us get our content seen. So if you could do us a big favor, and that would be to rate and review our podcast specifically on Apple Podcasts, because that's where the algorithm lives to kind of get podcast content out there on the internet. It would be great to just get a starred review from you, but even better is if you could give us a short sentence or two about why you like listening to the podcast, because that helps the algorithm know the more ratings and reviews that there are, that this is something that's interesting, and it will suggest it to other people looking for similar content. So we're really grateful for that. Plus, we're really grateful if you could give us a tip so that we can continue to bring you these weekly podcasts that you are enjoying, we hope. And you can easily do that if you go to our website, equip.org, hit journal, hit Postmodern Realities Podcast. And as I note every time, that any landing page under Postmodern Realities Podcast does have a link to give us a tip. And now back to our conversation about Mrs. Davis. And more importantly, we're going to start talking about something called metamodernism, and you will want to know about it.
So you were just kind of talking about just really what was so off-putting to you about Mrs. Davis. And is there any kind of scenario in which you could even recommend that any Christian watch this television series?
No, absolutely not. If a Christian wants to watch it to see if they find something in it that I simply didn't see, I mean, you know, more power to you, be my guest. But to say it as simply as I can, I think it is a profound waste of time, and you can absolutely find more productive things to do for 8 hours.
Well, this is, I guess we could say, we've had said this about some other books that we've critiqued, like we read this so you don't have to. So we kind of slogged through it. You didn't slog through it. There's some shows that you watch.
Absolutely did not.
I mean, there are some shows that you watch that absolutely refuse to watch. I watched one episode and said, I'm out. So I get that there are some shows that, you know, people should just definitely turn off. And this one is because there's no there. And that brings me to this question. You know, this show has gone tons of positive critical reviews from very well-respected critics. You know, secular critics like at the New York Times and different, you know, well-known television critics. And so we just talked about how it's not worth the time. Why do you think that people who are professional television critics just lauded this show so much? Although I would say they did have critiques like we did, and they said, oh, but despite that, this is such a great show.
Yeah, so this is sort of an interesting question. We've talked about this sort of going into this podcast episode, primarily because when I decided I wasn't going to finish the show, I actually turned to the critical reviews and started reading them because I was curious. And I've said before on this podcast, I am someone who tries to avoid reviews, especially when I go watch something. I don't like the idea that someone is giving me permission to like something. I think Rotten Tomatoes and that little score is like the worst thing ever. I remember I almost fell over when I think I walked into a Walmart and saw that DVD cases now had like certified fresh on their cover. Like it's giving you permission to like this movie. And I just thought that was the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. Coming from a filmmaking background, it irks me to no end. So I started reading all of these critical reviews, which were very positive. And one of the things I noticed, and I talk about this in the article that I wrote for you guys, but one of the things I noticed was so many of these reviews would like give a summary of the plot and say that it's well executed, but none of them could actually articulate what the show was about. And that was a huge red flag to me. Usually when you read a review, if it's a reviewer worth any salt, you know, they'll give a summary of the plot and then they'll try to find something in there worth talking about. And of course, you know, I write reviews and I'm sure there's a few I've written that don't actually do that well. So I understand the irony of me saying that. That being said though, that's generally what you look for across the board. Well, and across the board, with Mrs. Davis, every review that I read was doing the same thing. None of them could articulate what the show was really about, which, considering, you know, all of these grand themes, so to speak, that are in it, faith, technology, this is the stuff that, you know, elevated something like The X-Files to must-see television because of how it incorporated these themes and discussed these themes among characters of faith and, you know, atheists and believers and things like that. It was really fascinating. But this show, like you said, there's no there. And so it was sort of interesting reading these reviews and hearing, because I listened to some of them as well, but hearing and reading some of these reviews where these reviewers would say, here's what it's about in terms of plot. It's really weird. And all of them agreed that it was very disjointed, that it was weird and some parts didn't work and they didn't follow everything, but it was still good. And I kept thinking to myself, how do we go from it makes no sense to, but it's still really good? So I kind of think this is one of those situations where it's what I call pretentious filmmaking. And every now and then you'll come across something like this where something gets made that is weird for the sake of being weird. And because it's so weird and different and unique, film critics, people who make a living in the industry, try to put a stamp of approval on it because it's just different, even if it's not really that good. And then there's kind of like a hive mind where, I think I mentioned this one specific review I was reading. I was like, this is a reviewer who has absolutely no clue what to say about this show, but everybody else has said it's good, so she's just saying it's good. Because the review itself was so short and articulated nothing. And halfway through the article, she was saying, you know, it's a crazy show. It makes no sense. It's a roller coaster, wild ride that nobody can follow, but it's a fantastic product. Like, it's just kind of ridiculous. So I think a lot of that is just some people jumping on a bandwagon. And as you pointed out at the beginning, it comes from an executive producer who is really well established, who is really well known, whose work is known for being a little esoteric in and of itself. And so I think people can sort of get hoodwinked into something that's just nonsense by saying, well, you know, maybe he's smarter than I am and he's a genius for what he's putting out there. And, you know, I don't know about that. So that's what I think. That's speculation on my part, but that's just what I think.
Well, many Christians, including myself, thought he was brilliant at the beginning of Lost. I don't know if we thought that was true with the series finale.
Well, I did too.
Maybe that's a whole nother. We did an article on that, as a matter of fact, that people can go read on our website, equip.org.
Listen, I've liked so much that he's done. Nash Bridges, which was, you know, I was a kid. I had an aunt who really liked Nash Bridges and got me into it. But a lot of his body of work, I actually really, really like. I think he's good at what he does. This is just garbage, though.
Well, several of the films and TV series that we've recently discovered have this kind of, you know, quote, meta approach to them. And this, of course, is the approach that kind of came on with the blockbusters, you know, Marvel film blockbusters. But it's really been, I guess, exploded even in the indie film space. And I remember last year we had both seen the trailer for Everything Everywhere All at Once before it came out in March and thought we should cover it for the journal, which we did. And I don't know, we have a good track record because the previous year we covered a film that went on to win the Oscar. And then, of course, this film went on to win the Oscar for Best Picture. And so there's a sense in which we're experiencing this shift in pop culture, I think, from traditional films of yesteryear that had more linear stories to this new approach. So first of all, can you give us a framework of this meta approach? What is it? And help us to think through what that is, because it's definitely something different and audiences are just really embracing it. And just to piggyback on what you just said about the critics, I mean, Everything Everywhere All at Once, when it first came out, was just lauded by critics. They loved it. They thought it was ingenious. They thought it was brilliant storytelling. They just loved what it had to say and how it said it.
Yeah, so this whole idea of metamodernism or metamodern storytelling really exploded after Everything Everywhere All at Once came out. Now, there have been other films and stories that have played with this sort of way of doing things for a while, but it was really Everything Everywhere All at Once that put it out there on a whole other level. The best way I know how to do this, I'll simply quote Jonathan Rawlson, who wrote an article called Metamodernism and the Perception of Context, the Cultural Between, the Political After, and the Mystic Beyond. Very, academic and highfalutin title there. But what he's going to do in this article is define metamodernism to the degree that somebody can actually define a concept when you're in the middle of it. I know that's always sort of been the great problem of philosophy, is trying to get your arms around what it is you're experiencing in the age in which you live. But this is how he defines metamodernism. Metamodernism is a feeling and all that constitutes the feeling and flows from it. When we consider the mystery of consciousness and the human drama playing out on this charming anomaly of a planet, feelings are far from trivial. They have cosmological significance. One way to grasp the value of the idea of metamodernity is to say that it's about focusing our attention on our subject and intersubjective relationship to these times we live in when we stand in some quaveringly uncertain sense after, within, between, or beyond modernity. So there's a couple of ideas at play here that we should probably be familiar with. The idea of modernity, right? This thing that we're supposedly moving beyond. Modernity, the modern era, the age of the Enlightenment, those are all philosophical terms and concepts that some people are probably familiar with, others a little less so. The Enlightenment, the idea of rationalism, the triumph and empiricism, the triumph of science, the placing of science and observable facts on the pedestal. This was the great problem, the philosophical quandary coming out of the 1800s into the 1900s and the modern era. Of course, the Enlightenment project failed. World War II is clear evidence of that. The whole idea of Enlightenment being that humanity's progress is ongoing. The more that we evolve and the more that we do with technology, the better off it's going to be. Well, Oppenheimer's coming out, so that how well did we evolve? We've just built better weapons in another sense. So that's the idea behind the Enlightenment project has failed. Well, modernity, toward the end of the 20th century, we began to talk about post-modernity, this idea of moving beyond modernity. Now, I've talked before on this podcast about the validity of the idea of post-modernity. What is it? Is it even a thing? I mean, it's that idea of trying to get your arms around the cultural moment that you're in. But with meta-modernity, as it relates to storytelling, which is really what we're talking about here with the films, Everything Everywhere All at Once, to hone in and discuss this in terms of storytelling, really what is happening is a shift from what we might call authorial intent to, as Rawlson says, intersubjective relationships to these times we live in. So for anybody who's studied, theology or done seminary or things like that, this is going to take you into the realm of what is called hermeneutics, or how do you locate meaning? Well, when you read the Bible, we put a great capital in conservative Christian circles, evangelical fundamentalist circles, on something called exegesis. Ex, from, out of. The idea is that when you read the Bible, you lift meaning out of the text. You let the text tell you what it means, and you do that through context, reading contextually, looking for authorial intent. In other words, for example, when Paul wrote Romans, what was Paul communicating to his audience in his day? Figure out that first, then cross the bridge to apply it to me sitting in the 21st century. But in order to understand and rightly apply it, I have to understand what Paul meant in his context way back when. What you see is a shift now towards something called eisegesis, or reading into the text, or taking what I experience, my subjective experiences, putting that onto the text, and then trying to make the text speak to me based on my subjective feelings and experiences. And, in a basic hermeneutics class in, Bible college or seminary, that would be a big no-no. We would say that that's not how you locate meaning. Well, what's interesting and what's also very troublesome and kind of alarming is that if you just step outside of the Bible and you look at modern stories, forget the narrative of Scripture for a second, just look at secular stories, what you see is this happening. It's no longer about a traditional narrative structure, for example. It's no longer about a traditional story or a theme in a story. A story, as we think about it, it tells you something that's more than just stringing a bunch of characters and themes and plots along to tell you something in the end, which we would call a theme or an idea. It can be a bunch of random and disparate pieces that really don't tie together because there really is no overarching theme in the first place. And it's more about what you get out of the story. It's more about what you experience. And so more and more you see these films cropping up with, I think, like you were to use Mrs. Davis as an example, you were talking about there was a scene, whatever that you saw, that was just an interlude that seemed to go nowhere, that really didn't contribute to the plot in any meaningful way. In traditional narratives, if you're looking at something, trying to critique it, and you had something like that in a television series, you would go, well, that went nowhere. I mean, people used to sit around and talk about this stuff, right? Well, that was a plot line that went nowhere in the show. What were they trying to do with that? Well, now people latch onto that stuff. People see something like that and they go, oh, you know, well, that's interesting because it spoke to me. It means something to me. A lot in a very small space, but that's generally what is being talked about with this metamodern approach to storytelling. It's a shift of locating meaning from author, creator, person who made it with intent, to what I get out of it, to what it means to me on a very subjective level type thing. That's sort of what we're seeing.
So I guess my question is, you know, to contrast this metamodern approach, how do you compare that to more traditional approaches to filmmaking and television series? I mean, some people will look at traditional television shows and films and find them to be boring and slow and very old-fashioned. And also, obviously, they see older shows as being very much, you know, a kind of a white construct. They're racist, or they're anti-woman, they're sexist. So how do we begin thinking about hermeneutics, speaking of hermeneutics, to apply that to pop culture and specifically things like television series and movies?
So a traditional plot structure would be the thing that most of us are familiar with. We learned it probably second, third grade, something like that. You know, think of your basic triangle. Something has a beginning or an inception, a rising action, a climax in which the story reaches its quote unquote highest point where an important decision or something is made. Then the falling action leading to the resolution, and then something called a denouement, which is the ever after, so to speak. For example, when I teach the basic plot of Scripture, I typically follow something like that. Not because it's a construct that is laid onto something, but because narratives, stories, tend to function in that way. It's not that this is a construct that is brought and laid on top of the Bible. It is a construct that the Bible itself bears out. It has a very clear beginning that's very important to the story. It has a very clear rising action with the developing of the nation of Israel. Alongside the messianic lineage, it has a climax where Christ shows up, the Messiah appears, and a very shocking twist in the story where he is killed, of all things, but then he resurrects, and the gospel goes to the Gentiles, you know, the other nations apart from Israel. That's part of the falling action. The church begins. And then the resolution and the denouement we find in the book of Revelation, the return of Christ and the setting right of all that's wrong and all of that. I mean, it's a structure that it develops itself. And stories tend to follow that. And a lot of stuff has been written on that over the years. I know that's pretty basic stuff. But what you see now with this metamodern approach to storytelling is the exchanging of traditional storytelling methods for irony and satire, as I have talked about before. Now, it's not that traditional storytelling methods can't incorporate irony or satire. That's not what I'm saying. It is an overemphasis or a total reliance on irony and satire. Let me see if I can walk us through an example where you can see this quite clearly. And we'll talk about Mrs. Davis and how that fits into this. So if you think of deconstructionism in storytelling and deconstructionist stories, this is sort of the natural evolution of that. Here's what I mean. Let's go with one of my favorite genres, the Western. I grew up reading Louis L'Amour. I grew up watching old Westerns. I still watch old Westerns, still watch Gunsmoke, stuff like that. I love Westerns. Well, when Westerns first came to prominence at the dawn of the filming industry, and that's another reason I use this as an example, because Westerns have been there from the very beginning, and you can clearly see this trend in them. With the likes of John Wayne and James Stewart, you know, the white hat cowboys, the heroic cowboys who, you know, goes up against the black hat bad guy, the Lone Ranger, characters like that are very straight-laced. They're very morally upright heroes. But when you get to the mid to late 20th century, so 20, 30, almost 40 years after that, with the rise of Clint Eastwood, who I'm a huge fan of, love his films, what you begin to see is a deconstruction of those character types. And this is, again, this is not really hard to see. The Man with No Name that Clint Eastwood plays in the Dollars trilogy is night and day different from the heroic characters played by James Stewart and John Wayne. You can even see, this is one of the great things about John Wayne playing Rooster Cogburn, that character, is it was so jarring to see him in a role that was kind of an anti-hero because everyone was so used to seeing him as a hero. There was he was deconstructing his own characters. And of course, Clint Eastwood reaches its zenith with the film Unforgiven, which many consider to be the last great Western ever made because it was a total deconstruction of the genre. It literally took, it's actually one of my favorite quotes, comes from someone who was analyzing that film. And he says, it's like watching someone set fire to the genre and all of the tropes just burn away. And his point in saying that is it literally, every time you think the film is going to go right, it goes left. It's a total deconstruction and undoing of what made the Western a Western. So that was the deconstructionism that arose with discussions of modernity and postmodernity, that sort of thing. But on our modern context, in the early 21st century, we see a natural progression. We've deconstructed everything there is to deconstruct. Now, irony and satire. So let's look at Mrs. Davis for an example. The character of Mrs. Davis is introduced wearing an outfit that is a spitting replica of the Lone Rangers, riding a white horse. And you think, okay, but it's not a Western. It's this very bizarre religious technology show, and she's riding to the scene of a horrendously gruesome car accident, which occurs in the very opening scene of the first episode and already sort of turned me off because of how horrifically violent it was. But it's an intentional riffing on. It's an intentional irony. It's an intentional satirizing of the Western iconography, the genre. It's not a deconstruction. It's making fun of. It's ironic, it's satire, but it does it in a way that doesn't say anything profound. And that's the key difference here. With the deconstruction of genre, when Clint Eastwood deconstructed the Western genre with Unforgiven, which is actually a script, a wonderful script written by David Webb Peoples. When David Webb Peoples deconstructed the Western genre and Clint Eastwood made that role of William Money his own, it was to make a very profound point about how we can idolize all of the wrong things. This, on the other hand, what you see with Mrs. Davis is something completely different. There's no point. If there is a point, it's whatever you happen to find while watching it. And there are very clear issues hermeneutically there, because when you take this into the realm of the Bible, well, that ship isn't going to fly, especially when you get to somebody like Paul, who is very clear when he teaches his readers, if people come to you preaching something that's different from what I'm telling you, you put them out. you don't deal with them. If someone comes to you claiming to be an apostle, who doesn't teach you what I teach you, and he's not me or he's not one of the others, don't follow them. You know, that's quite different from, you know, find whatever you want in this and run with it. It's a whole different ballgame. So I know that's a lot of content packed into a very short span of time, but that's really what you see happening with this metamodern approach to storytelling.
You just noted that Mrs. Davis is satirizing various genres. You know, you talked about that opening scene where she's riding up in her nun's habit on a white horse to a gruesome murder scene, which ends up being like a hat trick almost. So what do you actually think was the intent of the executive producer, Damon Lindelof, and the directors regarding the storytelling of Mrs. Davis? I mean, they were interviewed, and what would they say that their point in making this series was? Because I've seen some very serious interviews with him regarding The Watchmen and The Leftovers, both having spiritual themes to them. But what was he trying to do with this series? What was Lindelof trying to do?
So I'll be honest with you. When I first started entertaining the idea of not finishing this series, my big fear, because I'm a creative person myself. I write screenplays, all this kind of thing. I understand that it can hurt when someone, when you feel like they don't give your work a fair shake, if they judge it prematurely, kind of like that idea of judging a book by its cover. And I always try to avoid that because I don't want people to do that to me. So what I did is I said, you know what, I'm gonna look up some type of what they call a postmortem. Oftentimes somebody like Entertainment Weekly or something like that will publish what they call a postmortem, where they will sit down with the creatives behind the episodes and talk about each episode, do essentially a postmortem on each of the episodes, an autopsy of the episodes, and really dig into their thoughts. So I looked up the postmortem for the third episode, which is the one that had all the blasphemy in it that, you know, really rubbed me the wrong way because of the tone and the execution and because of this metamodern approach to it. And when I found the postmortem, and there was one, the interviewer, I forget exactly who this was, I think it was published with a Sci-Fi Wire, but the interviewer basically made a comment at the start of this interview on this episode when talking about the character of Wiley, who is the character who had all the whole profanity-laced rant and blasphemies and all that. And the interviewer said something like, it comes across as very epic and stupid. This is what Lindelof said, and I quote, "I'll just say that Peacock would never go for this, but I would love Epic and Stupid to be one of our posters because I think that's exactly right." Now, Peacock is the distribution platform. But when I read that, the first thing that fired through my brain was, well, of course Peacock would say that, because what that would tell people is, don't waste your time watching this. There's no point to it. And I thought that was such an interesting thing to say, because it told me how unseriously the story was being taken. And what's even more ironic is that the whole time I was watching those first three episodes, I kept thinking to myself, why am I wasting my time watching this? When he said that, that sort of sealed the deal for me, where I thought, well, no, I'm clearly on the right track in terms of my thinking, that there really isn't a point to this. So I think I told you I wasn't going to finish the series, and you sent me an article, which was an interview with the director of the final episode. And this director had directed half the series. He directed four episodes, the first episode, the last episode, and a few others in between. But this is what the director of the final episode said. "Who knows where Mrs. Davis has gone? I love the fact that the show doesn't try to wrap that up entirely. I love the fact that the grander themes of the show in terms of faith, religion, technology, it's not a question we posit at the beginning and try to answer in the end. The answers we try to find are in the personal, intimate stories, but the bigger questions, they're carried by the breeze at the end, and who knows what's happened to Mrs. Davis. We've turned her off, so that's the only thing I know with any certainty, but what does that even mean?" Well, when the creatives who are putting the thing together can't tell you what the ending of their show means, can't tell you what their show is about, but all they can say is that the grander themes of the show, which he specifically says are faith, religion, and technology, are, quote, carried by the breeze at the end, end quote, in favor of, again, the personal intimate stories. Well, then why am I watching this? I'm not going to waste my time watching this when you don't even know what your show's about. And all of these ideas that would have been interesting for you to actually try to say something sincere and profound about, even if I disagree with you. You know, I'm not expecting somebody finds Jesus in the context of the show in the way that we would think about that. I'm not even expecting that. But I'm expecting you to have some type of statement be made. You know, that's one of the things I go back to this a lot, because I really do think it's a wonderful show, and because so many of the well-known screenwriters, Vince Gilligan, Howard Gordon, those showrunners started on The X-Files. Chris Carter's The X-Files, which Chris Carter, in an interview with, I think it was Innovative Tech, something like that, when he was asked directly what the show was about, this was after the show ended, he said, The X-Files is the search for God, plain and simple. And people are like, well, this is a show about aliens, right? But it's not really about aliens. And if you follow the series, that bears itself out. It's a show that explores the same topics as Mrs. Davis, but done in a way that is not meta-modern. Of course, it's a very flexible show and it has different episodes in it, and it's parody episodes and things like that. But by and large, it is interested in exploring these same ideas, faith, religion, technology, in a way, well, I'll say that is more traditional, in a way that does sort of take itself seriously and its audience seriously, unlike this. And so once I read what the producers had said, and once I read what the director had said, I thought, well, if the producers are saying the show is epic and stupid, and the distribution company wouldn't even let him promote it that way, and the director's saying that he doesn't even know what the show means, well, then I've got better things to do with my time. And that's just how I look at it.
Well, when we consider a series like Mrs. Davis, there's a sense in which nothing is sacred anymore, because they kind of take everything on and mock it in some regard. And that's kind of interesting, because it seems to me that the cultural zeitgeist right now tries to tread very carefully on not offending. And yet a lot of the current pop cultural exports that we have, so that would be things like songs and, you know, music, film, TV series, videos, that kind of thing. These are, you know, things that future generations will be looking at to kind of define the era that we're in right now. So are they going to see that really it was a time of inclusiveness, because everyone was really careful about how they portrayed different kinds of people? Or are they going to see this more as an age where we just let everything go? We could just do whatever we wanted, because, as you said, Damon Lindelof is saying his show is epic and stupid.
Yeah, I think you're really onto something here. To make a very long story short, this is a thought experiment I'll sometimes do with my students to illustrate this point. I say, all right, if the world as we know it ended tomorrow and all of us were wiped out, and the only thing that remained was like the electronics, the technology, and then, you know, 50,000 years from now, an alien civilization discovers Earth and starts, you know, going through all of the artifacts, what would they conclude about the time in which we live based on the artifacts that they recover? Songs, movies, TV shows, things like that. What you would see is one of the most uninhibited groups of people, where everything is fair game. We will make fun of anyone. We will mock everything. We will show gratuitous violence. We will show gratuitous sexuality. We will applaud gratuitous sexuality. And what's interesting to me is that if you just take a step back and look at, the broader culture as portrayed by, let's say, you know, a lot of mainstream media outlets. And let me be clear, I'm not one of these, you know, avoid the media at all costs, don't watch CNN, don't watch Fox News. I'm not one of those people. But if you just take a step back and look at the narratives that are propagated with just a little bit of common sense, what it seems to portray is a people that is very careful. It's like walking on eggshells in this culture. And it's not just me saying this. These are conversations I have with my friends. These are conversations I have with people at church. These are conversations I have with my students. Everyone feels like they're walking on eggshells, because you don't want to do something that's going to offend someone else. And I think what you see as a result is a very dichotomized and very confused people. Our cultural exports, our cultural artifacts will offend anybody and everybody, and nobody seems to care, except for a few certain groups if it doesn't fit a specific narrative. But when you look at the culture and the experience and the life experience and the day-to-day living, again, it's walking on eggshells. This is the age of where, this is the age of offense, the age of everybody's getting offended. And yet the artifacts that we are putting out suggest the complete and total opposite, that we're a thick-skinned people when, if anything, we're a very thin-skinned people. And I think that dichotomy, that contrast is really fascinating. And it tells you something about the age in which we live. We are a very confused people. And globalization is something we are not very good at at all.
Well, the title of your article talks about a crisis in storytelling. What do you mean by that?
Essentially, everything we've laid out. If you're looking as someone who writes consistently, I'm always finding that I write very traditionally, and I can really only speak from my personal experience here. But I think it gets to the heart of an issue in the culture at large. As someone who writes, I write very traditionally. And of course, you know, I'm not saying you write derivatively. In fact, the thing that I hear, you know, most from agents and things like that is, well, I don't know how to market your stuff, which is, you know, sort of like a backhanded comment, right? Well, you're not derivative enough for us. So it's not that. But what I have found is that, and even editing a magazine, I edit a magazine and reading the stories that come in, that it's a fiction magazine, reading the stories that come in, I'm sort of amazed at the number of stories I get that are, they don't go anywhere. There's no beginning, there's no middle, there's no end, there's no traditional plot structure, there's no theme, characters are not well developed. But there are a lot of characters who are, you know, LGBTQ. There's a lot of characters who are in the middle of some crisis of identity, who are in the middle of, you know, angst. It's almost like the teenage angst never goes away anymore. It's like nobody ever grows up. And I find that's more and more common. And when I first started getting those sorts of submissions, it shocked me. It really did. When I first started reading what other people my age were writing, you know, I walked away looking like a dinosaur. You know, I wrote things that sort of looked like, you know, Conan the Barbarian and Star Wars and Rambo and, you know, stories like that that have a more traditional plot structure. Yeah, and I try to make these things a little more intelligent than that. But you see my basic point. What you see is a seismic shift in storytelling. And I think it makes it very hard. And you see the crisis in storytelling in major properties. That's the thing that clues you into this. Look at Star Wars right now. I don't really get involved in the fandoms, so to speak, but I'm online enough to where I can kind of keep my finger on the pulse because it is a property that I grew up with and enjoy. But it's sort of legendarily divisive right now. It's one of the most divisive, you know, quote unquote, fandoms on the planet because there's a huge crisis in storytelling. And it looks like the new Indiana Jones film is, based on some of those early reviews that have come out, is set to be the same thing. It's very divisive. Do people like old-fashioned storytelling, or are we supposed to move beyond it? That's what everybody, you know, is talking about with Star Wars now. You see this also with James Bond, arguably the most prestigious film franchise out there because of how long it's been running and because of how clustered up it is within a particular family, which I've always sort of liked and appreciated that they keep it and they tailor that series a certain way. It's a way of movie making and filmmaking that is just not done anymore. Everything is now corporations and things like that and companies and studios, but the Bond series is not, and that makes it very special and separates it. But there are all these debates over, is Bond old fashioned? Is Bond done? Do we really need Bond? That was what made the film Skyfall back in 2012 so profound and powerful, is it actually took those complaints and made it part of the plot of the film. It took those questions and turned it into a plot in the movie. and sort of reasserted, this is why Bond is important. To quote Barbara Broccoli, the sort of the person who holds the Bond series, you know, she says, heroes will never go out of style. Heroism will never go out of style. You'll always need a hero. And Bond is there to sort of fill that void, fill that niche. It's a very old-fashioned, traditional way of doing things. It assumes a what we call a hero's journey, or it assumes the need for a hero to beat a villain, something like that. In these newer sorts of stories, this meta-modern approach, it's not necessarily the case. It's emotions, it's internal conflicts, it's things like that. And it's not to say that all films that come out of this meta-modern approach are bad. I mean, Everything Everywhere All at Once kind of had some interesting messages in there. We did a whole podcast on that and talked about it. And it's a very weird film that I don't ever need to see it again. But I really sort of resonated with some of the themes and ideas that were in there. What's more concerning to me is this broader approach that some critics, let's say liberal literary critics push for, that we have to abandon traditional plot structures because it's inherently evil or inherently racist, so to speak. Well, again, there's a traditional plot structure to the Bible. Again, and that's not laying on to the text, that's just reading the text from beginning to middle to end. I mean, Revelation, with its allusions to the Old Testament, assumes a traditional plot structure reading. David in the Psalms, looking forward to the Messiah, assumes a very traditional plot structure ending where the enemies are destroyed, things like that. So there's a real crisis in the world of storytelling right now that for creatives, I think, makes it very difficult. Everyone sort of says there's no better time to get into filmmaking because everybody can make a movie now because you have a cell phone. Yeah, but you got to look at what people are going for. You got to look at what is selling. You got to look at what studios are willing to distribute. And there's a real crisis of identity of sorts in the storytelling world that I think is worth paying attention to, especially for Christians, because it will have ramifications for how the Bible is read and how the Bible is taught. And that's where it's important.
I also want to ask you about Gen Z students, because how do they see storytelling? You're a high school Bible teacher, and this generation has grown up on metamodernism. And if you show them traditional storytelling artifacts like films, they find them very slow, for example. So how do they, see more traditional storytelling, and particularly, how do they see the Christian story? Because they're so used to this metamodernism in the kinds of cultural things that they, interact with and they consume, that maybe just reading through the Bible in a sitting, reading through a gospel in a sitting, that would just be too difficult for them, or they would find that boring, especially kids who are more seeped into pop culture.
Yeah, if you've got another hour, I can talk about this. it's a fantastic question. It's an important question. So I teach sophomore Bible. I also teach Bible for college students online. And I've noticed some similarities across both, but in particular the high schoolers, because they're a little younger. You're absolutely right that traditional storytelling methods seem boring to them. I've seen this time and time again. They find films slow. They think that there's, because a something takes itself seriously. I notice this all the time, actually. I'll use this as a specific example. Anytime there's a film that is being watched or a television series that is being watched that's a little older, that takes itself seriously or its narrative seriously, but it doesn't have like really great effects, rather than consider the theme at work, rather than consider the character development or what the show is trying to say, all they can do is sort of point and laugh at the effects, or they can complain that the show takes itself too serious. I see this all the time. What's interesting about coming to the Bible then, they've never thought of the Bible just as literature. And when I say that, I don't demean the Bible, because the Bible is literature. It's literally how God has chosen to present his word to the world, is as a literary form. So it would make sense to read that as literature and not a code book to be cracked or a code book to be deciphered. It's not that. It's literature. And so I've often said before, and I think I've even said on this podcast, I tell people all the time, look, if you want to get ready to read the Bible, figure out how to read the Bible, go find a novel read it cover to cover, and watch some movies like Star Wars that have a traditional plot and follow that and figure out how plot, characters, and dialogue all work together to communicate themes and ideas. And then you're ready to start reading the Bible. Because it's a narrative. It's a story. Over 50% of the Bible is narrative. It is story. And the other 50% deals with or banks on your knowledge of the 50% that is narrative, especially when you get to the epistles of the New Testament. Paul has a hermeneutic of the narrative that he works out in Romans. The other writers, the other apostles, the other writers of the epistles assume their readers have an understanding, a working understanding of the narrative, especially the narrative of the Old Testament. So there's a narrative there. So what I've found with the kids is they bring this metamodern approach to it. All they can do is apply. That's all they do is apply. If I hand them a passage of scripture, oh my goodness, I saw this so many times just this past semester. If I hand them a passage of scripture in context and I say, read this, now tell me what is being talked about. The default setting is to talk about how they apply it to their life. And I'm saying, well, you know, I'm glad that you're applying this, but that's not what I'm asking you. For the purpose of this assignment, I don't particularly care how you're applying this to your life. I just want you to be able to tell me what it's talking about. Because if you don't get what it's talking about, then you might be applying it the wrong way and getting a completely different reading than you're supposed to. A great example of this, I don't know if we've talked about this in this podcast, but just by way of example, is Jeremiah 29:11. I see this all the time. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to see you prosper, not to see you broken, and all that kind of stuff. I was given that on a card when I graduated high school, as if to say, here's how you know you're going to go off to college and do great things, because God knows the plans he has for you, plans to see you prosper, not to see you brought to ruin. Well, if you just think about Jeremiah 29:11, if you go back and read the whole book of Jeremiah, well, those words occur in a context. And that context has nothing to do with me sitting in the 21st century. It has everything to do with an Israel in exile. And if you read the verse before it, it literally says, after 70 years have passed in Babylon, I will deliver you, essentially is what is being said there. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. So even the people who heard the promise of Jeremiah 29:11, in 70 years, most of them are going to be 6 feet under. They're going to be dead. So even to the people who heard the words of the promise, it doesn't mean that they're going to come out and prosper. No, what it means is that God keeps his promises to those people because they were delivered. What it means is that God is faithful. Even when all hope seems lost, he's faithful to keep his promises. And then that begs the question of what promises he's made to you and me sitting in the 21st century. And will he keep those promises to us? Well, the whole narrative of scripture is a testament. I mean, the whole narrative of scripture rests on God's ability to do what he says he's going to do. If God doesn't keep a single promise that he makes, even just one of them, then we're all hosed. We've got major theological problems. But throughout the narrative, God keeps his promises. And so when I try to reorient, I call the first few months of dealing with kids and people in hermeneutics the rewiring process, because it's like you've got to go through and undo all of these little knots in the wires that have been tied by really well-meaning grandmothers who give them cards that say things like Jeremiah 29:11. So the kids who've grown up in this metamodern storytelling, when they go up to the Bible and they're just trying to apply it to their own subjective experience and talk about how the text makes them feel, what I do is just teach the Bible. And I know that sounds really trite, but I really don't mean it that way. I teach the Bible as a narrative. I teach it as literature. I start to show them what we might call a traditional plot structure in the Bible. And what happens every time, students say, oh my gosh, they say, I've never seen this before. What they start to say is, it finally makes sense. I feel like I can read the Bible and have an understanding of what's happening in the plot and not just try to find a way to make it apply to me. Because the fact of the matter is, if that's how you read the Bible, this, let's call it a metamodern approach, this subjective feelings approach, when you hit passages like Romans 9:10-11, oh, you are going to struggle. Because some of what Paul says in there, if you don't have a solid understanding of humanity's problem and sin, oh, that's going to rock your world. I mean, I watch this happen when we go through Romans with my kids. In fact, you mentioned sitting down and reading a gospel in one sitting. Here's what I do with Romans. This is an assignment I give them. I have a printout of Romans that removes all chapter and verse notations. because that's how it would originally have been received by the audience. So I remove all verse notations. I remove all chapter notations. It's one continuous document with paragraphs. And I give that to them. And the assignment is for them to read it and annotate it in one sitting as best they can. And they always come back and say, this is a new experience. I've never thought of just reading a book of the Bible in one sitting before. Like it's a letter with a coherent method of thought. Like you can start at the beginning and go to the end and track Paul's argument. And that's the assignment. I don't ask him to tell me what they think or tell me what it does for them or how it makes them feel. Just tell me what Paul is saying. Track his argument from start to finish through this letter. And then we'll go to application. Then we'll go to meaning. And what I think is the most profound thing and the takeaway here is that simply teaching scripture, traditional narrative structure, teaching them the plot of the Bible, scripture alone, not a textbook, not what somebody else says it is, not what somebody else comments it is, but just teaching the text and keeping them in the text. There's no substitute for that, none whatsoever.
I will note for our listeners that a lot of times in the Christian Research Journal articles, when we quote Bible verses, we quote them from the ESV. And there's actually an ESV version of the Bible called the Reader's Bible. And they've removed the verse numbers, the section headings, and the footnotes. So if anyone's interested in trying that for themselves, they can look up one of those. I'm sure there are other translations that do it too.
Yeah, there are now. Originally, it was, as far as I know, it was just the ESV who was doing it. But just to piggyback on that very quickly, when I was at Moody Bible Institute, I picked up one of those ESV Reader's Bibles, and I thought, oh my goodness, this changes everything. So I told several of my friends about it. One of them went and picked it up. He came back to me about 2 weeks later, and he said, this has changed everything for me. He said, this has absolutely revolutionized the way that I read the Bible. He said, well, I just started in Genesis chapter 1. He said, and it has never occurred to me to just read the Bible as a story before. He said, it actually made sense. And I'll never forget that. He was a brilliant, brilliant student. And to have that kind of visceral reaction to doing something as simple as removing verse notations, that always stood out to me. It was very powerful and profound. So it is a testament to reading the Bible as a narrative.
Well, finally, on a different note, I have a fun rapid fire question for Cole. We asked them so that our listeners can get to know our authors a little bit better. And we've spent this whole episode critiquing Mrs. Davis, which we said was terrible, and also talking about storytelling. So what is the worst movie you've ever seen?
You should not ask me that. Actually, no, I can tell you. There is one film that I genuinely, genuinely regret watching. And it's not even because it's, you know, not well made or it's so bad it's good or something like that. But the film Hereditary, I think it was a 2018 film. I deeply regret watching that film, and I think it's one of the worst films I've ever seen.
Now you're going to have everyone going onto Google and Googling that.
I know. It was in the back of my head. I was like, do I want to say this? Because people are going to look, and it actually has really fantastic reviews. That's why I watched it. But just to put a fine point on this, it was one of those shows that I started watching it, and I got the same feeling about it, but it's a horror film, so it's a little more visceral, that I got with Mrs. Davis. And I finished Hereditary, and I wished I never would have. So that's part of the gut instinct that I've honed. When I start to get that feeling, I pull the plug and walk away. And that was the film that taught me my lesson.
Well, thanks, Cole, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast. And coming up this summer, we will be covering the final film, I think it's going to be, in the Indiana Jones series, as well as Oppenheimer that we mentioned in this podcast.
Always a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to episode 344 of the Christian Research Journal's podcast, Postmodern Realities. Today, we talked about Mrs. Davis, the TV series streaming on Peacock, with our author of our review, Cole Burgett. His review is available for free at our website, equip.org, and you can look for it. And it is called Mrs. Davis and the Crisis of Storytelling in the 21st Century.
Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that, and every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.